Righto, folks, this is the latest chapter, the latest edition, the latest great revelation from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, how are you this fine day? And I say this fine day because in the last 24 hours before you and I have sat down in front of these microphones, the weather's been a bit inclement, hasn't it?
I feel much better, thank you. I've cooled down. I was very hot and bothered during all that ridiculous weather. I don't like the heat. I'm like you. I prefer it like this, I must admit. I don't sunbathe. I'm not somebody who lies out on a beach baking for hours on end. So this is much more comfortable. I can sleep. But I feel very sorry for all those people who've been drowned out by the weather this weekend.
It's shocking.
You know, we've had flooded tube stations and all those people that were up in Southwold, you know, Suffolk, I should say, for Latitude Festival. They all must have drowned, come away like drowned rats.
I live very near there, as you know, in Orwell Quay, which is a marina just outside Ipswich, you know, so I'm not very far away from Southwold at all. And the weather there sometimes, you know, can be excessive because it's near the coast, but not like we've seen it lately. We're only talking about London here, you know, sort of, you know, subways being flooded. And close to me in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, by the way, well, it's a few miles away, but there's a place called Worcester Park, and it's a suburb of Greater London, just off the A3, the main artery down to the south coast. I couldn't believe the pictures I saw of 4 or 5 feet of water on the streets. I mean, I don't know where it came from. It's, you know, you look at your local high street and imagine it now walking along it and it's all normal, and then put 5 feet of water on it. I mean, it really is very odd.
It feels to me like the planet is off kilter, like we've sort of spun off our axis or something, and everything is so extreme. I'm sure you saw the pictures of Siberia on fire.
Yes.
I mean, Siberia is traditionally the coldest place on Earth.
Yes.
The most extreme weather temperatures. But now they had lightning strikes on dried out forests.
Yeah.
And they're battling fires, which because it's melting all the permafrost underneath the soil,
that's right,
it's releasing these very dangerous gases into the air,
that's
which,
right.
You know, all the time, it feels to me like every day something is happening to chip away at planet Earth a little bit more.
Well, Siberia is one aspect of it all, but I saw a programme, I think it was last night, saying that reindeers are now under threat because they live on that permafrost that you're talking about. You know, they have to live on very hard, solid ground because that's where they come from, and that's all changing as well. Oh, dear me. You know, what are we in for over the next decade or so? Who knows? Now, Miss Jones, we haven't spoken to our millions of listeners since you and I were on the red carpet in central London, the Odeon, Leicester Square. It was quite a night, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, first of all, we had no idea we were VIP invité, did we?
Well, I think I have an idea that I'm a VIP, to be honest. That would
yeah, well, you were the one moaning the most about joining a 2-mile queue.
Well, that's right.
I had a feeling we shouldn't be at the back of that queue. So
you're very right, indeed. So I barged through the front door and said, "Don't you know who I am?" Or something.
He really did say that.
Words to that effect. No, I didn't, actually. I've never used that. Do you know who I am? I just said, "Hi, I'm on the VIP list." And they said, "What?" And I gave them my name, and then all of a sudden the ticket came out. But after that, it was all very good, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was quite nice bumping into Mr. Kenwright at the top of the red carpet stairs.
Yeah.
You ran off and got your picture with star of the show, Jenny. Jenny Seagrave. I was going to say Jenny Agutter then.
Difference. Not confused, to be honest. Jenny Agutter is the Railway Children or whatever it was called. What was that great film she was in?
The Railway Children. So tell me, what did you think of the film?
Yes, I think it was great. I mean, Mr. Kenwright was the producer. Jenny was the star of it. And Mr. Kenwright, the producer, I think paid an awful lot of money to acquire the rights of Blondie, the music of Blondie, which, funnily enough, I saw a Blondie video last night when I was just flicking through the channels. And, of course, it's you can't miss Blondie because of the lead singer, who is very blonde, and the group's named after her. What's her name again? I've forgotten.
Debbie Harry.
Debbie Harry. Thank you very much indeed, you know. But, no, it was marvellous. The only problem was that, of course, it was a very, very hot night. And I insisted on wearing a jacket. You told me not to, but you can't really turn up at a thing like that without a jacket on. So I found an old blazer at the back of the wardrobe, which I hadn't worn for years. And amazingly, I was still able to get into. But when I got home, I don't think I've told you this, when I got home, quite late on, you know, after the show, 9, 10 o'clock, something like that, I had to throw away both the shirt I was wearing, which was a sort of dark coloured shirt, and the blazer, because, and this is not a nice thing to consider, they were so drenched in perspiration from, you know, the very, very hot night, they were irrecoverable, and and I decided not to bother, so I chucked them both away.
Hang on, haven't you got dry cleaners where you live in Stockbreakabout? Sorry,
probably, but I just thought, God, this is. I was. You said we're going to end up like wet rags. You didn't, because you put on a flowing black dress and you had your black sunglasses on. You looked absolutely star material.
Whereas
most people who looked at the pictures we put out, a couple of pictures afterwards, said, "Hey, Porky, why do you look so dishevelled?" I didn't think I looked that dishevelled, but no, I just thought these clothes are not going to be worn again. So, bang, they've gone out.
I thought you looked elegant and cool. So, what did they know? I was there. They weren't. Yeah. Did you throw your glasses away as well in the pocket of the jacket then?
No, they disappeared before I got home. I put out a tweet saying, the problem is when you put the mask on, obviously, your glasses steam up. So it must have either been getting on or getting off the tube or the train to get home. And what I do is I take my glasses and I put them in my top pocket. That's the left-hand sort of breast pocket in a blazer, you know what I mean? And, you know, at the end of a train journey, I took the mask off, went to get them, bang, they'd gone. And that's the fourth pair I've lost. And the particular pair I lost cost £365. But I've lost four pairs now during lockdown. So that's over £1,000 worth of glasses, I'm afraid, during...
Well, I've told you the solution. You need a cord around your neck.
Yeah, but I'm not going to put a cord around my neck because people think I look like an old man. And I'm not.
Who cares what people think? Why do you care?
Well, no, I'm a young go-getter. Talking about dress attire and uniforms and all that, was your father, the late and great Ken Jones, sports writer extraordinaire, was he a member of the MCC?
No.
Marylebone Cricket Club?
Because cricket wasn't his thing, really.
No,
he did play cricket as a young man, but covering cricket, that wasn't his sport. He was very much boxing and football.
Yes, yes, I appreciate that. It's just that, you know, guys of his sort of stature sometimes become honorary members of great austere.
I tell you what it was about my father. He didn't like anything that smacked of elitism. He was very much, you know, from a South Wales Valley, a man of the people.
Yeah.
He didn't like Wimbledon for the same reason, because he said it was too elite an organisation, and it just was about keeping people out rather than bringing people in. He didn't like things that.
That's very interesting, because what I was going to say was that yesterday there was a new cricket competition called the Hundreds, right? And it was played at Lords, which is the home of the MCC, the Marylebone Cricket Club. And it's an odd sort of relationship. Marylebone Cricket Club, you know, was formed in the 1800s, and it is, you know, a very special. Its home is Lords. Lords, of course, is the home of cricket, you know, the long room at Lords and all that kind of stuff. But in this new competition, which started yesterday or 2 days ago, they relaxed the dress code. So normally you have to wear a jacket or a blazer and smart trousers, and you have to have a shirt on. And many of the MCC wear their traditional tie, which is called the bacon and egg tie, because it's yellow and crimson. It's a very distinctive tie. And I have to say, I like traditional traditions. And I, you know, I'm a bit of a snob. I like elitism. I like Wimbledon. I like the MCC. I like the Football Association. And they've relaxed it. And I thought it looked dreadful. All these people at Lord's who were scruffy and wearing, you know, not a jacket, open neck shirt and all that. I wish we didn't let our standards slip.
Well, I do agree with that. And I always have said that people who show up to the Royal Opera House in jeans or casual dresses and open-toed sandals, not appropriate. Yes. The same as people who come to church wearing shorts, and some people do, believe it or not.
I can't believe that.
I just think you ought, yes, you ought to make the effort on certain occasions. I do go along with that. But I think elitism that excludes other people deliberately, that's not really to be supported.
Yeah.
Not in my book.
Miss Jones, you're a church warden now at St Bride's. You know, we've told our audience that already, so that's no great secret. But surely as a church warden, you could say to somebody who turned up at the door of St Bride's, a wonderful, magnificent church just off Fleet Street, if they turned up in shorts, you surely would ban them, wouldn't you? You wouldn't let them in.
Absolutely not. No, the church is there for everybody, and people have the right to set their own standards if they want to worship in our church or indeed in any other church. They should never be shown the door.
Oh, right.
I don't know whether that applies to establishments such as Westminster Abbey.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, strictly speaking, a wedding, a funeral, any event that takes place within the walls of a church.
Yeah.
We don't have the right to say, no, you can't come in, even if it's a technically a private event, because the church is a public place. It's a public service. So we can't really tell people they can't attend. We do have, and he wouldn't mind me calling him this because he calls himself this, we have a tramp called Pete, who lives on the streets outside St Bride's.
Mm-hmm.
And when we serve drinks and snacks at the back of church, which we've recently started doing again, he will come in and have, you know, share the drinks and the food with us. And let me say, it's fairly obvious that he's there. I'm sure you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
I don't think he has access to a bathroom all too often. So, but we can't tell him he can't come in. You know, he's as welcome as the next person.
Well, that is a very godly attitude to take to life, you know, if somebody's down and out and all that kind of stuff. If Pete ever disappears, Miss Jones, let me know, because many would say I could take his place, you know. I'd be next in line.
You better get those clothes back out the bin.
That's right, yeah. I'll become the St Bride's tramp. I have known St Bride's, obviously, for many, many years. I've been to remembrance services there for
memorials. Yeah, we've memorials. Got actually a very sad funeral this week. We have Peter Willis's funeral.
Oh my God, Peter Willis, just to remember our millions of listeners, is the executive from the Daily Mirror. He invented Britain's Got Talent.
Didn't. He created the Pride of Britain Awards.
Thank you. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Britain's Got Talent is Simon Cowell, something rather different.
That's right. Pride of Britain. But definitely that became a national and mega television event, didn't it? Carol Vorderman I always remember about, what's it called? Britain's Got Talent. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
No. Carol Vorderman was also involved in Pride of Britain.
Pride of Britain.
Put your teeth in, Mike. She presented it. I'm not sure if she still does, but she famously, or Piers Morgan actually took the credit for this. Mm. Either Carol Vorderman or Piers Morgan or both of them introduced Paul McCartney to Heather Mills.
That's right.
The one-legged model who he later married and had a child with.
Yeah, and then later gave £25 million to, and we've never heard from her since. But good luck to her. Everybody deserves their chance in life. Talking about us going out on the town last Thursday to the, the premiere.
Wasn't it good to be out as well? It felt really nice to be. I was a little bit nervous, and obviously we wore our masks where we had to
nervous.
And all that kind of thing. Yeah, but just being out there, just in on a summer's evening,
among
people, just looking around, and there was a vague sense of normality, but not really.
Yeah, no, I agree. Now, it's 4 days since, right? And I've been nervous every moment since that night came and went and we got home and all that kind of stuff. Because I thought to myself, I can't believe I've got through this. Although we wore our masks and all that, we were in the VIP area with the writers of the film. And we didn't have masks on then because we were drinking champagne. Well, you were drinking champagne. I was drinking white wine. I don't drink champagne because it plays on my dicky heart. But you know, I worried about it and I've been worrying about it for the last 3 days. Now, I thought to myself, the symptoms, if you get COVID, start between 3 and 6 days after you've been infected. And this is day 4. So fingers crossed, I'm hoping like mad that I didn't get it from anybody. But I'm reading far too many stories of people who've been double jabbed like me and who take precautions like me and have still managed to get it again. And the latest is our old pal, Piers Morgan, who has been knocked for six by getting COVID again, even though he's had the double jab.
Yeah, well, they've never said that being double jabbed protects you from getting the virus. No. Nobody's ever said that. What the message is that you're less likely to be very seriously ill or die if you have had the double jab. So you still have to take precautions.
Oh, I do.
And you still have to look after yourself. But Piers doesn't actually know that he got it at the final of the Euros. That's he doesn't know that. He doesn't know where he got it. I know that the Mail on Sunday liked to blast this headline saying that he contracted it at the match.
Yeah.
Nobody can tell us that.
Well, there were a lot of people there. I mean, that's the point I was making is we went into a crowd of people. That cinema was absolutely packed, okay? We were lucky enough to be in the VIP area, so there was a lot of distance between us and other people. But you mentioned that queue we nearly had to get into because I couldn't work out where to pick up the tickets. And that queue had like hundreds of people in it and they were all going into the same area in the cinema, all sitting next to each other. So I have to say, you know, it'll be a long time before I feel confident enough to go back to a football ground and watch my team Everton, who are playing Chelsea in London early in the season, without really fearing for my own health.
Oh, sure. I mean, we're with this for years, you know. Yeah. It's the ones I feel sorry for are people of my children's generation, the 20-somethings, because all their prospects have been shattered. They've missed out on so much. I know we all have to a certain extent, but they're at a point in their lives where things were beginning to happen and everything is on hold. And I think we've got this for years to come.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. You know, I think it's going to have a profound effect on the way society moves forward. Now,
what do we say now, by the way, to all the deniers, those who still insist that COVID doesn't exist?
Well, it's not so much the deniers, it's those who don't want to take the vaccine. You probably read, or you may not have read, Karen Brady is the vice chairman of West Ham, an excellent businesswoman. You know, she really is, I would say, the leading lady of football. She's done a fantastic job there. And she wrote a column last weekend. She's got two teenage kids, asked them both to go and get the jab, and they both said, no, we don't want to. I think it does more harm than good. Now, if we've got a group of people in that sort of age bracket who are resolutely not going to get the jab, then I'm afraid we've got a real sort of blockage in the what I would call the pipeline to freedom.
Yeah, I have a cousin who's in her late 40s.
Yeah.
Whose daughter currently has COVID, and the mother, my cousin, still insists that COVID doesn't exist.
Mm. Yeah, well,
what do you say to somebody like that? I mean, it's,
I don't know. I've no idea. How can you call black white and how can you deny the facts and all that kind of stuff? I've no idea.
By the way, that going back to the premiere the other night of Off the Rails, wasn't he nice, the screenwriter Jordan Waller, who we stood talking to?
Lovely chap, honestly, really lovely
and
chap.
And what a story, what an absolutely extraordinary story, his life. You know, he had three mothers.
Right, yeah, go on.
So his mother conceived him by sperm donor.
Yes.
And she had a female partner at the time.
Right.
They later on broke up and his mother took up with another lady. So there were three mothers in his life.
Right.
And he's now become a sperm donor himself.
Golly, amazing story.
I mean, it's actually a more amazing story than the film we saw, isn't it, really?
Well, yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. It was...
But what a charming guy. And I thought I've seen you somewhere before. I definitely have.
Mm.
And I looked him up later on. Did you ever see the series that Jenna Coleman played Queen Victoria in on television?
Jenna Coleman.
She was the girl in Doctor Who, and she played Queen Victoria. It was called Victoria. Daisy Goodwin wrote it.
Right, yeah.
And he played Lord Alfred Paget.
Well, sorry, he's an actor as well as a screenwriter.
Yes, he's mainly an actor, but he wrote this on the side, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. What a, you know.
Very talented young man. And weren't they very pleasant?
Yeah, lovely. Lovely guys. You wouldn't have known that they were the people who made the film unless you drew it out of them and got them to talk about why they were in the VIP area, would you?
No, not at all.
Just going back to St. Bride's, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
I look at obituaries in the Times and the Telegraph all the time, mostly because I like to read about Spitfire pilots who at 18 got into a Spitfire and roared up into the air and fought the Luftwaffe. But every now and then you come across an old colleague, you know, who you've worked with. And the latest one I saw was a guy called Simon Dring. And I have absolutely no doubt that his picture will be on your, you know, table of honour in St Bride's very soon. He was a BBC TV reporter. It says here, a reporter who covered conflicts around the world and was made an honorary citizen of Bangladesh because he basically sort of rescued Bangladesh from civil war. It's an amazing story. It's far too complicated to go into, but he was one of these guys who, and we still see them. We still see them on Sky, we see on the BBC. Wherever there's a war, this person's got a tin hat on and a microphone in the hand, and they're whispering because shells are going off around them. And that's a special skill in our business, isn't it, being a foreign correspondent? And I sometimes wonder why people do it, because I might have done it when I was younger, and I did do it, actually. I got bombed and I was in wars and all that kind of stuff. But old Simon was doing it until he was 77. And I have to say, you know, once I'd gone past about sort of 40 or 45, I just wanted a quiet life.
Well, I know what you mean. I was listening to John Simpson on the radio on Saturday morning.
Yes,
he was talking to Dermot O'Leary, and I was in the car just listening to this, driving down the M20. And he's written novels which are sort of based on his real life experiences as a war correspondent.
Yeah.
And Dermot asked him why he was now writing these novels, and he said it was to have the experience that he wished his life as a war correspondent had been.
Right.
So he's really kind of turning the story into the one he would have liked to have lived, if you know what I mean.
Who, John Simpson?
Yeah.
But John Simpson was in all sorts of war zones. John Simpson was once in a situation, I remember, when Bin Laden, the man who was the architect of the attack on America and brought down the Twin Towers in New York, Osama Bin Laden, once... Bin Laden, that's right, yeah. Once wanted to kill John Simpson when they were in somewhere in the Middle East. I think it was like Saudi Arabia or somewhere like that. And and the local tribal chief said, no, these are good people. We're not going to kill them. That's how close he got to being killed by Osama
bin Laden. Yeah, but you're missing the point. It's not that he didn't have those extraordinary experiences, but the glamour of the side of those things and the sort of character that he was, he's created what he would have liked it to be like instead of what it was actually like. It's a sort of fictitious extension of what he experienced out there.
No, I understand what you're saying. One of the people who's on your shelf of honour at St Bride's, of course, is Marie Colvin, isn't it?
Oh, she is there, yes.
And, you know, I have so much admiration for Marie Colvin. I mean, She was reporting on a war which most people didn't care about, I think in Sri Lanka. She lost her eye because of an explosion, a missile or a bomb or something blew up. Despite that, and for the rest of her life, she, as we know, she wore a black patch over her eye. She's a romantic figure, Marie. She still went back into the field and eventually lost her life when she was targeted by the Syrian army, who wanted to get rid of her because she was sending reports back to the West revealing, you know, the horrors of what they were doing. I can't imagine that sort of bravery.
There is a kind of live by the sword, die by the sword mentality among these people. And you always think, if they carry on doing this, eventually it's going to get them. A bit like somebody like that guy, Steve Irwin in Australia.
Yes,
do you remember
him?
Famous wildlife guy.
Wasn't he killed by the tail of a fish or something?
Well, he was pierced through the heart by a stingray's lethal sting.
Yeah.
And he'd been wrestling with alligators and tying snakes in knots around his neck and all kinds of weird stuff over the years. A real daredevil. And I sometimes used to watch his programs and think, one of these days, because he takes too many risks. And I think if you are that extreme a risk taker, eventually the risk is going to get you.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think Marie must have known that. I remember once having a drink with her in... I can't remember the name of the place now in Soho, a downstairs basement bar. Jerry's, is it? Yeah, I think it was Jerry's, And I remember talking to her and thinking, what a fascinating woman, because she was very sexy. you know, and she was dressed up nicely and had a mini skirt on, all that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking most of the time, you know, she'd be, I don't know, cowering behind a wall in Syria or something like that, bombs going off. Amazing people. And the other one I remember, and you're right about this, I think some people are just driven to do it. And we've talked about this guy before, a guy called Bob Fisk, who died about 6 months ago, and I talked about his obituary. But Bob lived in Beirut all the way through the civil war in the Lebanon. I mean, you couldn't have lived in a more dangerous or depressing place anywhere in the world. You know, where shells were flying over from one direction and flying over the other, and the house next door was suddenly blown up. But Bob just said, that's where I felt I should be. He was very pro-Arabic, and he felt he had a duty to, you know, be the voice of the Palestinian population, really.
Do you ever see Alex Crawford on Sky
News?
Yes,
I do. And
she's an amazing correspondent, isn't she? But she lives in South Africa. She's got children.
Yeah.
And she's always off in a war zone. And I look at her. She's an incredible journalist.
Yes.
But I watch her sometimes and think, oh, my God, your kids are at home. And there will come the day, if you carry on doing this, when you'll never see them again.
Look, I totally agree with you. And do you know what? Sky seemed to really want to concentrate on, you know, overseas stuff, wars and all that. Alex Crawford, who I have, you know, as much admiration for as you do, she's sometime reporting on wars in countries that I've never even heard of. And I mean that, you know. And I think to myself, nobody's interested in this war. Nobody cares. Nobody's watching this. Why are you there for all the reasons you've just mentioned?
I tell you one thing Sky are getting right at the moment, though, is their daily climate show. I'm learning all kinds of stuff from that programme. Yeah. It's on for an hour early evening, and then I think they repeat it later on. But some of the stuff coming at me from that, you know, I had no idea.
Yeah.
The various aspects of why, well, planet Earth, as I said before, why we're in so much danger.
Yeah.
And people are so complacent about it and doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah, well, I think that's the programme in which I saw the report on the reindeers, you know, and you know, once you start talking about reindeers suffering, everybody starts worrying. OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the Arachic writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, have we talked about the John Stonehouse story? I can't remember.
We haven't.
No, isn't it an amazing story? Somebody's writing a book about it now. I think it's his daughter. And just to refresh the memories of our millions of listeners, John Stonehouse was Postmaster General in a Labour government when he was overcome by debts, and he had a mistress of 6 years who was his secretary, a very, very glamorous woman. So to get out of it all, he decided to literally disappear. Went to Miami, put his clothes in a locker, went towards the beach. People thought he'd gone into the sea and drowned and disappeared. In fact, he went to the airport and got an aeroplane to Australia. It was an amazing story, wasn't it?
And not only that, but didn't he turn out to be a paid Czech spy?
That's the allegation. The allegation was that he was so in debt, he was taking money from the, you know, the Czech government, from the Czechoslovakian embassy in London, having big lunches and envelopes full of money and all that kind of stuff to provide them with information, which actually you could read in the newspaper. But they then were getting their tentacles into a sort of government ministry, you know. Amazing story.
Extraordinary story. What do you think it was the inspiration for Reggie Perrin?
I'm sure it was, yeah. It was exactly the same story. He disappeared from Miami, flew to Hawaii, and then from Hawaii to Australia. And he would have got away with it, except for the fact that he took a load of money with him, which he'd drawn out of the bank in London. This is money which people claimed that he'd taken from a charity that he was running. And then he went into banks in Melbourne and started paying in sums of 40,000 Australian dollars. And the bank authorities thought, you know, this is a bit odd. He seems to have a lot of money and all that. Rang the police. For the first 3 days, the police thought that they'd found Lord Lucan, because all this happened.
That's right. Oh, yeah, I remember.
Yeah. This all happened 6 weeks after Lord Lucan disappeared. So there were two amazingly, not famous, but amazingly notorious men loose in the world somewhere. One was Stonehouse and the other one was Lucan. Lucan, of course, has never been found. And it turned out not to be Lucan, but John Stonehouse. An amazing story.
Oh, and the way they established the difference. Apparently, they told Stonehouse to drop his trousers. Because Lord Lucan had a very long scar down his right thigh.
Oh, really?
And that was the way they discovered that John Stonehouse wasn't Lord Lucan.
Is that right? Well, mm-hmm. Amazing. I learn something new every day from you, Miss Jones, I have to say, you know. And when it comes from the trouser department, it never fails to surprise me, really.
That's a very suggestive remark, Mr. Parker.
No. Miss Jones, do you think I would ever question your integrity? That's right.
It's a family show.
It is a family show indeed. Listen, within the world you work and mix in, you must know Dr. Fox.
I've come across Neil Fox at times over the years, yes.
Yeah. I mean, is he in your sort of coterie of famous sort of DJ friends and, you know, musician friends, anything like that?
I had crossed paths with him a lot in the past. I haven't seen him for some years, but he's been through the mill a bit, hasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. I saw an interview with him. And at one time, this guy was flying his own helicopter. He had three homes and all that kind of stuff. He was dragged into the scandal after the Jimmy Savile affair, you know, which drew loads of people in, some of whom were guilty, like Max Clifford, who went to jail for 8 years and died in jail of a heart attack, and others who were questioned. I think some of your friends weren't they? But then, of course, cleared because they were totally innocent of all the allegations.
This was a terrible witch hunt. It was basically they didn't get Savile, the police. People knew about Jimmy Savile for years.
Yes, they did.
Very high-powered people. People like Esther Ranson and Des Wilcox.
Yeah.
Who knew what was going on and they said nothing. And it's a scandal of beyond all proportions. But yes, a lot of people were picked up on false allegations. And the police...
Richard even.
Cliff Richard, Paul Gambaccini.
Yeah.
The police pursued these fervently because they didn't get Jimmy Savile.
Yeah.
Utterly shameful.
Yeah.
But I think Neil Fox pretty much lost everything, didn't he?
That's what I'm saying. I read this interview and he spent his life savings and a lot more in defending himself against the allegations and he never got it back. You know, he said, I thought that when you defended yourself, if you spent your own money and then you were cleared of all charges and all allegations, somebody would give you your money back. But he didn't. He lost everything. And
well, he was a bit stupid there, to be honest, because didn't he investigate that before he started spending? You know, who is going to give you the money back if you're cleared?
Yeah,
who would give you the money back?
Yeah, but he felt he had a duty to himself to defend himself. And I can understand that. You know, I've been in situations in my life where I've thought, hang on, I've been badly done to here. I want justice. I'm going to, you know, I'm thinking about a legal case or something like that. It's very, very expensive. But often what happens is, Leslie-Ann, is that you get so far into it that you can't pull out. If you pull out, it makes it look like you're guilty. So you have
to
take it all the way to the end, you know?
Yeah, of course. And I've always said the only winners, are the lawyers. The only winners are the lawyers, and I think I'm going to come back as a lawyer because they've had enough of my money over all the years.
Yeah.
It seems to me that even those who win these very high-profile cases, they haven't actually won.
Yeah.
Because people still will say there's no smoke without fire,
yes,
and there's the taint of guilt that follows these people around for the rest of their lives.
They will, you're absolutely right. This is the worst bit about this piece I said. In 2014, he was doing his show at Magic FM. And guess where their studios are? In Leicester Square, where you and I were just a few nights ago, you know, at the Odeon Square. The police came in and arrested him on the spot in front of all his colleagues, all his workmates, all his bosses, and marched him out. And that was the start of his nightmare, which lasted for 4 years. I mean, that's pretty horrendous stuff, isn't it?
I think also that kind of experience leaves a very deep scar.
Yeah.
And it's something that even though you pull yourself together and you march on and you get on with your life, that psychological damage is never going to leave you. And at some point in the future, that will rear up and have repercussions.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. Now, Miss Jones, you're going to have to enlighten me here because it was yesterday or the day before I read a newspaper and the first five pages were given over to the wedding of somebody called Kitty somebody or other, who was apparently Diana, Princess of Wales's niece. And this is the society wedding of the year. What's her name? Is it Kitty Spencer?
This is Kitty Spencer. She's the daughter of Diana's brother, Earl Spencer.
Yeah.
And his first wife, Victoria.
Yes.
And it
was anorexic, wasn't she?
She was, yeah. Poor girl, yes. Yeah. And this wedding took place in Italy. She's married. Kitty is 30, and she's married a 62-year-old billionaire. Right. So what first attracted her to the billionaire old enough to be her father? It's a very odd story, this, because it seems that neither of her parents attended the nuptials. She didn't wear the Spencer tiara, which Diana wore at her wedding to Prince Charles.
Really?
This is a very unusual thing. You know, in this kind of aristocratic family, the women of the family will always wear the family tiara when they marry.
Right.
So there's a lot of unanswered questions here. Also, why did the newspaper give over five pages to that wedding that nobody really cares about?
No,
I mean, Kitty Spencer she's somebody we vaguely know about, but
I don't
she's
even
not
vaguely know her.
She's not in line to the throne or anything, is
no,
she? So
no.
I find it very strange.
Well, what happens, we know better than most in Fleet Street, is a friend of a friend of a friend suddenly knows the person who owns the newspaper, and, you know, it's all powerful and all that kind of stuff, and you do it. But
they don't need the publicity. They've got money coming out of every pore of their bodies. They've got a wonderful life to look forward to together.
Yes.
You know, why do they need that publicity? They absolutely don't.
And also,
especially not in the Mail on Sunday.
Yeah, and also, it doesn't look like whoever the proprietor or editor of the newspaper that published it was doing. It doesn't look like they were trying to curry favour with Diana's brother, because, as you quite rightly pointed out to our millions of listeners, he wasn't even there. He didn't even go to the wedding.
He's not in any pictures. I mean, we've got this arrangement, haven't we, with Italy at the moment. I suppose if he travelled there, he would have had to quarantine for however many days, and then the same thing coming back.
Mm.
So it's all complicated. In which case, why have the wedding in Italy? Why not have it here so that your family can attend?
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
All very strange.
All very strange, but, you know, life is stranger than fiction. Now, Miss Jones, you were out with me the other night. Thank you very much indeed for joining me. We got a lovely response, by the way, to all the pictures we put out from the Odeon, which I keep going on.
We did, didn't we? Yeah,
it was nice. We did. But look, I've got this piece here, and it says, "Slap it on, chaps. Britain's first makeup store for men has just opened." Now, I have to reveal a secret to yourself and our millions of listeners, and that is that over the last 12 months, I've become quite adept at making up my own face. And that's not because I've suddenly decided to use makeup on a daily basis. But if you're doing television, and obviously during the lockdown, a lot of it was done from home, and the camera was sent down here, and then I had to set up the camera, sit in front of it. But I had to put on my own makeup. And I have to say, it's very, very much more difficult than I ever thought it would be. So I'm now taking my hat off and paying a tribute and a salute to women folk who've had to do it every day of their lives.
Well, we don't have to do it, of course. I think women are very fortunate because we have cosmetics that we can enhance our features with and play certain things down, you know, hide things. It's a lovely tool to play with. And we wouldn't be without
it. Jones, for goodness.
Ooh, oh, come on, that's your dirty mind, not mine.
No, come on, come on.
Honestly.
Lovely tool to play with. Anyway, please.
Anyway, I learned a lot of tricks over the years with makeup artists in television studios and so on. So that we are able to do that kind of thing ourselves.
Yes.
I think in daily life, although in theory, there's nothing wrong with men wearing makeup if they want to.
Yeah.
I think this is a thing that probably should be confined to younger men, trendier men.
Yes.
I think men in middle age, probably if you went out in a full face of makeup down to the pub, you might be ridiculed.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Yeah.
So people of my kids' age are going to be out there doing this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Nobody will bat an eyelid or a mascara eyelash. But I think if you were to go out in full makeup, I just worry about that a little bit.
Yeah, no, I do. I didn't realise how complicated it can be. So when I do TV at Jeremy Vine on 5, and the makeup girls there are absolutely wonderful, I have to do it myself now, but at their direction. You see what I mean? You still can't interplay, so to speak. I think we will after August the 16th. But no, first of all, they make me smear this stuff all over my face. And when I say stuff, it's like a colourless sort of gel. Then I put foundation.
Oh, that's a primer. That's a primer to smooth everything out. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Then I put foundation cream all over the place, and then I put powder on top of that. And, it's very complicated. My problem is, and this is something that the makeup ladies are grappling with, is that I've got a blob on the end of my nose. And, seriously.
Who bit you?
No. Well, this is quite interesting. It's just down from the bridge of my nose, and it's a big white blob. And it is a cancerous swelling, but fortunately it's benign because I went to get it, I thought I better get this looked at. And I went to a skin specialist at a private hospital, and they took a biopsy, and, it went away and came back and said, it is cancer, but it's benign and we can remove it for you. And that was about 3 weeks before lockdown, and I've never had it done. And unfortunately it's got worse.
Oh, you need to get that taken out. I've had a few similar things. BCCs, basal cell carcinoma, they're called.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There's another one called a squamous cell carcinoma, which I've had removed, two or three of those as well.
Oh.
And if you don't get them removed, they can turn nasty. It won't stay benign forever.
Yes.
So you need to get that looked at and dealt with.
Yeah, I wouldn't like to lose my nose. My face would
exactly.
Work.
And that does happen. So
yeah,
if I were you, I'd go and see your specialist again.
Yeah, well, I will, honestly, as soon as we get time and the world opens up again, I will. But the point of my story with makeup is that the more you try to cover it, the more prominent it looks. And it's a real problem for the makeup girls, honestly. Particularly as on one side, you're quite right, it's getting worse, and a sort of vein is starting to push out. You see what I mean? So there's a sort of red side to my blob, and it's getting harder and harder for them to disguise it. But you know what?
I was with you the other night. I didn't even notice it.
Well, it's nice of you to say that. I think most people will start to notice it soon because it's getting worse. But anyway.
Get it looked at, Mike.
Yeah.
Don't let that go because it's going inwards as well as outwards.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. When you're in Scotland, Ms. Jones, because you are a worldwide traveller, being the Arachic writer extraordinaire, have you ever had a tonic cake?
Is that a euphemism?
No, honest to God. A tonic cake is like a marshmallow wrapped in silver and red foil.
Oh, I know those things. Yeah, we used to get them at kids' parties when we were little.
That's right.
Yeah, I have had those. They're a bit strange.
Yeah.
They've got a sort of quite a thick biscuity bit at the bottom.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
And you nearly break your teeth biting into it.
Yes, that's absolutely right. But, they're as much a part of your life in Scotland as Iron Brew is. You know what I mean? There are certain things in Scotland, haggis, Iron Brew.
Oh, that is disgusting, Muck. Iron Brew, isn't it?
No, I quite like it, actually. I mean,
no, I don't like it. I'd rather have Lucozade. I love Lucozade.
Well, in the days when I used to drink fizzy drinks, I don't know, of course, because of my diabetes too. You know, that's in addition to my heart and sciatica problems. Not that I'm moaning about my health or anything, but the old tonic cake. But the reason I talk about it is that I saw a piece written about the original founder, Sir Boyd Tunnock, born in Uddington, South Lanarkshire.
Lanarkshire, surely.
Yeah, that's right. And at 16, he joined the family confectionery business, Tunnock's, founded by his grandfather in 1890. So isn't it marvellous that now Sir Boyd Tunnock is running a company founded in the back kitchen of a tenement house in the Gorbals by his grandfather. But the point of my story is Sir Boyd Tunnock is 88. He gets up every morning at 5 o'clock, is in the factory by 6 and conducts operations all day long. Imagine having that sort of motivation and conviction in life.
I think that's fantastic. And he's a lesson to us all, isn't he, really?
Yeah.
But haven't we always said, get up early and get it done?
Yes.
The earlier you get up, the more you achieve during the day. And the less tired you are at night.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Gary Neville has a great expression. Gary Neville says, get up and attack the day. And I totally agree. So there we are. Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for having joined Miss Jones and myself. Miss Jones, I just want to remind our audience that we're all going on a summer holiday in August. So our next podcast after this one will be the last before we go off to sunny climes through the first 3 weeks of August. And I just in advance want to wish everybody else a very happy summer holiday if they're going away.
Absolutely, yes. It's been quite a run, hasn't it? But time to down tools a little bit and just take stock and pause for a bit. But I'm sure people have got plans. So we will regroup in September after that, won't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely, we will. Right. OK, folks, on that note, thank you very much indeed. Miss Jones, thank you. See you all again soon.
Looking forward to it.
Oh, my God. Peter Willis, just to remember our millions of listeners, is the executive from the Daily Mirror. He invented Britain's Got Talent.
No, he didn't. He created the Pride of Britain Awards.
Thank you. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Britain's Got Talent is Simon Cowell, something rather different.
That's right, Pride of Britain. But definitely, that became a national and mega television event, didn't it? Carol Vorderman I always remember about, what's it called? Britain's Got Talent. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
No. Carol Vorderman was also involved in Pride of Britain. Pride of Britain. Put your teeth in, Mike. Yeah. Apparently, they told Stonehouse to drop his trousers because Lord Lucan had a very long scar down his right thigh.
Oh, really?
And that was the way they discovered that John Stonehouse wasn't Lord Lucan.
Is that right? Well, mm-hmm. Amazing. I learn something new every day from you, Miss Jones, I have to say, you know. And when it comes from the trouser department, it never fails to surprise me, really.
Very suggestive remark, Mr.
Jones. No. Miss Jones, do you think I would ever question your integrity?
Your integrity,
that's right.
It's a family show.
It is a family show indeed.
It's a lovely tool to play with, and we wouldn't be
come
without
on, Ms. Jones,
it.
For goodness. Ooh,
oh, come on, that's your dirty mind, not mine.
No, come on.
Oh, honestly.
Lovely tool to play with. Anyway, please.
Anyway.